Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 145 with Mark Kenny on owning and operating a 4,500 apartment unit portfolio. Many of us in the real estate investing world have aspirations of owning hundreds or even thousands of units, and today's guest, Mark, is here with the basic message that there is no reason to wait and that you can start big and start right now. Among the jewels of wisdom to be found here on today's show are the apartment investor partner value add skills. In other words, what you can bring to the table in order to share in the feast of partnering on a large multifamily deal. Interesting, right? Let's jump right to it. Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. Mark, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Doing well. So the listeners don't know, but we were both just commenting on the weather. And usually we start the episode off with kind of talking about what the weather's like in each area. Just give people a background from where you're recording. So do you mind?
Yeah. So I grew up in Michigan, but I'm thankfully in Dallas, which is typically much warmer. But today we're pretty cold, wet, and damp. And I don't like it, but we're probably mid-40s today, I guess, getting down to I think below 30 maybe later tonight. So, and then back up to mid-70s next week. So it's short-lived compared to when I grew up in Michigan or Chicago where you're at.
Yeah, and I'm here in Chicago wishing that it would go back up to the mid-70s, but I'm going to have to hop on a plane. I didn't realize it got so cold in Texas. Obviously, I've never been there myself, but I'm surprised that you were telling me it's like 30, 40 degrees. I just never would have guessed.
I didn't either before I moved down here. Now I know.
Found out the hard way. You're committed at that point. So who don't already know who you are, I know you've got like a big following. A lot of people know who you are. You own a lot of apartment units and been in the game a while. But if anyone doesn't already know who you are, could you give a background kind of how you got in real estate, what the business looks like today? Reader's Digest version?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, so I grew up one of seven kids and had a twin brother, and you know, we had kind of everything, kind of what we needed, but nothing we wanted. And we're both kind of like, man, we need to do something different when we get older. And, we went to, Michigan State, both my brother and I did. And when we were seniors in college, we started looking at real estate, small, 2 to 4 unit properties. And actually got a deal, when we were like 22, and started buying smaller properties just together. You know, just he and myself were, and we didn't syndicate or raise money from anyone else or anything like that. Both worked corporate world. And then I had an IT business I started as well in 2008 that was doing quite well. But the issue I ran into was that I had no time at all. I mean, like I would sleep 3 hours a night and, you know, ignore my wife. I didn't have time for her and things like that, which caused some problems. So 2013, my wife was like, you need to do something different. And, you know, we both loved real estate. We've been buying real estate since, you know, we got married in our early 20s. And we said, well, in order to really kind of replace our income, IT income, which was pretty high at the time, going to have to look at bringing other people into deals that we bring in together through syndication. And that's what we started doing. And we started buying, you know, looking at 100 plus unit properties at that point in time. And it took us almost a year, unfortunately, to get our first deal for a lot of different various reasons, but we got our first deal. And second and third got easier and easier, and we purchased over 5,500 doors since that time. I own about 4,500 right now. Sold about 1,000.
Nice. And is part of that story how you ended up going from Michigan to Texas, or is that a totally separate chapter?
I had a project down here. I worked for a company at the time called SAP, a software, pretty large software company. IT guys would definitely know the name. And I had a project down here in Plano, Texas, and came down in November. It was 65, 70 degrees. And my eyes were kind of open because I really didn't travel too much. And I was like, man, this is pretty nice. And everything was new and kind of fell in love with it. But it took a while, but it was all work related. I probably would not have done that if my work didn't, if you want to say forced me to come down, I wouldn't have come down here.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm always curious about the motivations behind people moving around the country. Like myself, I moved from Philadelphia to Chicago. So my daughter was like 12. This is like 4 or 5 years ago. And it was like, you know, being a weekend dad really wasn't cutting it. And I knew I'd regret that looking back, kind of like you probably felt like when, you know, you kind of made the decision and your wife, and it's like, hey, if I continue on this path, this is not something I'm going to look back on my life and be maybe not totally happy with. And real estate gave us both the freedom for that. Do you want to touch on that? I don't know if part of that story maybe helps other people making the same kind of leaps of faith like you had to do, I'm sure, and like I had to do when I moved to Chicago. I know that the move wasn't really the part, but certainly the leap into something totally different and not normal compared to what we're used to is exemplary.
Yeah, I mean, I was, if this addresses the question, I was kind of looking at a bunch of different ways to get out of my IT business. And not because it wasn't financially rewarding, because it definitely was. I had a lot of like Fortune 100 companies and things like that as customers. But I was looking at franchises and self-storage and custom development, subdivisions, everything I looked at. And it kind of came back where a friend of mine was doing multifamily syndication. I looked at that and invested with him. And for me, it really came down to the decision. I mean, either I could have kept doing my IT business and done very, very well financially, and probably not be married today, frankly. Or I had to make a decision and say, okay, even though I'm busy and, you know, I don't really sleep much and have all this stuff going on, I need to find a way to make this work or, you know, kind of restore my marriage and things like that. It was tough because I literally, you know, I'd work 80 hours a light week for me. I mean, it really was. And didn't sleep much and things like that. So, but I told my wife too that to me, I said, you're going to have to help me on this if you want to make this work, because I simply don't have enough hours in a day. And she kind of got involved in it and things like that as well with me. And it was my hardest thing for me was to turn down projects, because I looked at every project that ever came by from an IT perspective I would take, no matter even if it was unrealistic timeline, things like that, I would take it and make it work. So for me to sit there and go, okay, I'm going to actually not do as many projects and cut my time from 100 down to 50% and 50 down to basically zero. I wasn't making as much money initially in real estate. I'd made enough to live and do okay. But I had this mindset where I did not think I was going to replace my IT income, because I was doing really well. And we've far surpassed that. I mean, many times over since we've, you know, been in the business now. But it was hard at first, because, you know, you're sacrificing even more. I felt like I sacrificed already a lot to begin with my time and taking care of myself with fitness and things like that. I just didn't have time for that. But you have to kind of get yourself back to a position where those things become more of a priority. But I had help, you know, like I said, my wife Tamil helped me and helped me tremendously. Now she's full time in the business. But for me, it really came down to, do I want to, you know, grow up with my kids, you know, having lived through a divorce and things like that. And that was, you know, not a very good situation to be in, frankly.
Yeah. Congratulations for pulling through it. It reminds me of a story that a mentor of mine told me early on. And there's a method in, I think it's in the Caribbean, the country or where at in the world isn't as important as the lesson that is contained, but they use a method for capturing monkeys in the Caribbean, we'll say. And what they do is they hollow out a coconut and they attach it with a chain to a tree. And the size of the hole in the coconut is just right so that the hollowed out coconut chained to a tree filled with some peanuts or something of that nature, when the monkey sticks its hand in the hole, it's just big enough where it can get its hand into the hole, grabs the peanuts, and then it refuses to let go of the peanuts in spite of losing its freedom here. So it will not let go of the peanuts. Even when the guy comes back, he's not going to do it. And it's so simple for him to make the decision to let go of the peanuts. And it's like the mentor told me, like, what are the peanuts in your life? And like for a lot of us, just like it sounds like in your situation, it's hanging on to, you know, the source of of monetary success, the money, the things that are working, the things that were comfortable to us. And you had to go through a time where there was less when you're letting go of the peanuts, but you did it, unlike the monkey. And it sounds like you got the freedom on the other side. And it's like, you know.
No, that's a great story. It was twofold. I would say definitely monetary for sure, because that was always a fear of mine for a long, long time. And the other one is that's really where I got my self-worth. You know, that's where my job, I was, you know, I tell people I'm not really good at a lot of things. I'm good at a couple things. That's about it. And for whatever reason, I was wired, you know, God made me a certain way. And for whatever reason, that, you know, the IT consulting was something I really picked up very, very quickly and was able to, you know, generate a lot of customers and things like that, just by doing good work. But that was the other piece is putting your self-worth and, you know, your whole identity in your job. And that's a bad thing to do.
Yeah, it makes sense. So you mentioned buying real estate early 20s. And for me, I sold cars. I had, you know, a hodgepodge of jobs, dropped out of college, found real estate at 26. I'm 39 now and started buying rental properties in the last 3 years or so. And so now I'm seeing some of the cumulative effect now of the rental rates increasing, and I got the depreciation starting to build up and knock down my taxable income. Of course, there's the mortgages being paid down. And so like now, 13 years in real estate business for Dan Breslin, I'm seeing the this is what everybody's talking about, buying rental property. But I had to go out. I had to make the successful job. I had to find kind of the money machine, because I really didn't have IT and I wasn't good at much else. And so like for me, flipping houses and doing that kind of stuff is what led to this. And so like I'm feeling like I'm buying rental properties, like quote unquote, like the average age. But you started in your early 20s. I mean, what are some of the barriers, you know, mental or otherwise, that maybe you had to overcome, or maybe if you see other people overcome them who are even participating in your deals, to getting into buy and hold real estate at an earlier age than I did?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest, because we do coaching too, and the biggest thing we see is that when people start talking about buying, you know, 100 plus unit properties, which is typically what we look at, they just can't get their mind around it, because it just seems so big. And reality is that we've done bigger, you know, and the smaller properties, and the smaller properties was a lot more work for me personally, because I was doing most of the stuff myself and evictions and things like that. The other one is just, it's, you know, anything's new, then it's kind of, people are like, okay, well, I've never even knew you could do this. And, you know, whatever. I know an uncle that lost money or whatever it might be. I think it's just kind of understanding that, hey, you know, here are some history. There's a lot of stats out there about how well real estate's done and how people have done, you know, their net worth has grown tremendously as a result of it. And the other piece is that you mentioned is a tax benefit. We don't pay any federal income tax. You know, Tamil and I don't, at all, which is a good feeling. We have, you know, a bunch of paper losses. People are like, oh, you don't make any. It's like, no, it's all paper losses through depreciation and things like that. And we do cost segregation, bonus depreciation. But I think, you know, if someone's going to look at a property to invest versus like a stock and things like that, there are certain things that are, you know, there are pros and cons to every investment. I think as you look for investors, you have to be open to that. You know, advantage of stock is it's liquid. Real estate typically isn't liquid, right? So if you're up front with people, I just talked to a guy right before this podcast, and, you know, he's looking at putting $100K in a deal, and it's his first deal. And I said, well, I mean, you know what, maybe you just put 50 in, you know, just to kind of, you know, whatever he's comfortable with, right? That perspective is, don't push people into things. Just try to help educate them. And it can be a slow process, because I know one of my friends, you know, for 3 years, he kept saying he's going to invest in a deal, and just recently in the last 6 months invested in the first deal after 3 years of talking to this guy. So just be a regular person. Don't try to be salesy. Don't try to be someone you're not. And, you know, understand that every deal has pros and cons to it. So if someone asks you, hey, what are the negative pieces of this deal? And you say, well, there are no negative parts. Everything's great about the deal. That's probably not true. There's probably something about the deal you don't like. I mean, every deal I've bought, there's been something about it I don't like. but there's enough pieces of it that I like and make, you know, make it work that way. So I think, you know, taking it slow, even though everyone wants to go fast, which is really hard for people that want to go fast, I understand that. But, you know, teaming up with people that are doing what you want to do is the best way to get involved. And just let people talk to people that have been through what they went through. So if someone's a new investor, let them talk to somebody else that was in the same position they were 2 years ago and understand, you know, they can relate better to them because they went through that same transition. It's not easy, frankly. I think, like I said, just be open and transparent with people. That's probably the best way to get people to trust you.
Perfect. So let's talk about just a bit. I mean, you had this experience with the smaller units. That's my experience right now. I've had the dream, like I know all of the a good chunk and percentage of the audience listening right now has the dream or is working the dream of, you know, buying units, buying more units. Why not buy a 100-unit building? It seems like the natural progression to a lot of us, you know, real estate investors, to start with two flat, duplex, single-family houses, and, you know, we have our eye on this end goal of 100-unit, a 200-unit, you know, to get to a point where maybe there's several thousand units under ownership that we're managing. What type of advice would you give to someone who has not had that experience yet and is starting brand new? Would you suggest they followed your path and my path and start small, or just jump right into the larger deals from the beginning?
You know, I think the question that they have to ask first, are they willing to partner with somebody? And if they're not, because they just don't trust people, or because they, you know, they're a control freak, or it might be, which happens. If someone's open to partner with somebody, then I would look at starting big for sure. I would look at, you know, finding somebody that's done exactly what you want to do. You have to come in and help them with something though. And I tell people all the time, you know, if someone comes to me and says, well, I have a bunch of time, what do you need help with? It's just not valuable to me. Unfortunately, you have to have some sort of skill set. And the skill set doesn't require you to have a bunch of money necessarily. You can go raise money if you have no money, right? You can go find deals. You can analyze deals, those type of things. But if you are willing to work with somebody, partner with them, and you're willing to get good at something, whatever that something is, to add value to somebody else, then I would start big for sure. I wouldn't even start with the small stuff personally. With that said, I don't think there's anything wrong when people do that. People are like, oh, I'm, you know, I started with a 4-unit and, you know, getting like beating themselves up about it. It's like, well, you know, 99% of people in the world don't buy anything. So you're already further ahead than them. And you learn from doing that. If I had to do it over again, I would not buy small at all.
Yeah. I'm going to put an underline under the part of somebody, cause we see the same thing you just mentioned where people, hey, you know, I'll come work for free. Like, it actually costs time and effort to tell you what needs to be done, even though you're willing to work for free in some cases. It's more of a cost for the other person. So it's like I took a step back when I had no money myself, Mark, and I evaluated like, okay, Dan Breslin's sitting here living in my mom's house in one of her, you know, one of the bedrooms I grew up in. And it was like, what is this? What can I bring to the table that people care about? And, you know, for me, it was the deals. I had to become the source of deals. And if I could figure out how to build a pipeline, how to talk to people, how to negotiate, how to figure out the nuances of making offers and then countering the offer back and forth, the whole complex, you know, science of deal making, if you will, was something that I set out and I didn't realize how complex it was going to be early on. But I mean, to date, we've closed 165 deals, you know, this year alone, and we've got 91 in inventory. So we're doing what I set out to do 13 years ago, but I had to figure that out. And it's like, I had somebody come along who really didn't have a great skill set like that when he approached me. He listened to the podcast, just, you know, same, still listens to it. He's going to listen to this one. Now he's a business partner of mine and he's running a market, but he didn't have a ton of skills. He has sales skills. He had the ability to persistent ability to pick the phone up and call. And he had a little bit of luck in that he moved to another city where I wanted to do business. So like the willingness to move to me, that's something that sometimes could be really valuable for the right person to pick up and move their family to Atlanta. And I ended up working with him, and like his commitment was really high. I knew because he went to a new city, and I know how people have like that fresh start, lack of distractions. It's a beneficial thing to start over. I learned myself when I moved to Chicago here. And you know, now it's a multi-million dollar market for me. And so like, I always try to encourage that. Hey, if you're trying to partner with people, sit down, figure out what you're willing to bring to the table. Yeah, maybe you don't have a ton of cash. A lot of people don't want or willing to partner.
Right.
You probably do have time, but like, let's figure out what are some of the other things that work so that you have something to talk about when you're approaching a partnership. I mean, makes sense, right?
That's perfect.
Are there any specific examples in the multifamily space where people are adding value? I don't know if it's capital raises or what other things would be like valuable to someone who was doing hundreds of units per deal.
If someone is a syndicator, I would say, you know, a couple things valuable to them. And it depends how their deal flow is. We have strong deal flow. So for most syndicators, if someone could bring capital to the deal and there's some legal aspects, how they do that and things like that. But let's assume they can bring capital to a deal. That's very, very valuable. The other one could be putting like earnest money down. So let's say, for example, a syndicator has a couple deals they're working and they have to put, you know, a couple hundred grand down in a deal and they're like, I'm tapped out. I don't have liquid or it's out on another deal. So someone comes in and do that. That requires money. Raising capital doesn't require any money of the person actually doing that activity for sure. You know, analyzing deals, if people sit there, even if they actually have the knowledge to do it, they might not have the time. So we have people in our group that will engage other people in the group to analyze deals for them. And they partner up together and the person analyzes deals gets a percentage of the deal, things like that. But money for sure. I mean, just to be frank, right? I mean, money is always the attractive piece if you can bring that somehow to somebody else's deal. Like analyzing deals, finding deals, things like that. But those are probably the main, but money in my mind, number one, at least for me personally.
Yeah. I mean, it always seems to be one of the big limiting factors. I know for me, including and a lot of people I meet who say, yeah, I want to get into real estate. For me, I hesitated from, you know, 18, 19, 20 until I was 26. Thinking I have to save enough money to buy my first house. I didn't even know I could put 20% down, and I was sitting here trying to save up, you know, 100 grand or whatever it was. Never going to reach that goal. And then, you know, finding those deals, like, man, if you have a good deal under contract, if you have the ear of that seller who has the perfect, you know, multifamily deal, like you're bringing something of value to the table for sure.
Right.
Cool. What would be... So however many thousands of units, I think you said like 4,000 plus, give or take, right?
Yeah, we want 4,500 right now.
So there must be some kind of like team or teams in place, and you've got the coaching. What like would be your leadership philosophy? You must have had to, and maybe even did it and brought in this skill set from the IT business. I don't know, but like managing teams, growing, attracting the right people, just in general, what would be like your leadership style?
For me, I mean, people tell us this all the time, and it's not even the skills as much as it is the integrity, character, doing what you say you're going to do, and treating people with respect. And you might sound like, well, those things all sound kind of obvious. Well, yeah, they kind of are obvious, but I can tell you a lot of people don't follow those things at all. you know, they're disrespectful to people. They treat them like they're better than them. They get a bunch of money, and then all they talk about is the money and the cars and everything like that, which is fine if that's what they want to do. But it's, that's not who I'm trying to attract. So we're trying to attract more of a family community environment where, you know, kids can come to our events if they want to and things like that. And our kids hang out with different kids. And so for me, it's more always doing what I say I'm going to do, treating people with respect. And always doing, you know, much, but always doing the right thing. Even if you think it's going to cost you something, those are critical things. Like I said, most people would say, oh yeah, they follow that, but they don't. I mean, example after example, people don't follow any of those things I just went through.
Yeah, you're right about that. I'm trying to get like some electrical work done. And we flip a lot of houses, but like even the guys that work on our flips don't want to work in my high-rise building. So it's like pain to even get them on the phone or get them to follow up. And then like that's across the board out there in society. So like returning phone calls, emails, getting back to you when you said you were going to follow up, like real simple, basic stuff. I'll tell you what, Mark, when you were talking about it, you said like treating people with respect. And I know along the way, I'm sure I've had my, haughty moments where I probably would look back and like cover my mouth in shame or something. You know, that would be proud of those moments. But on the flip side of that, I've had, quite a number of people. We run, networking events in the cities, you know, Atlanta, Chicago, Philly, where we do business, and I attend those things and I speak at a lot of events. And, you know, now it's been 13 years since I got into business, and I'm amazed at how many times people either like call on the phone, we're in the midst of a deal, so I'm like really engaged with them. Or maybe they like meet me face to face at a group and they're like, you know what, Dan? Say, I remember I talked to you after such and such, and like you were real cool. Like you gave me a couple minutes there, and I honestly don't remember who they were. You know, it's like I'm meeting them for the first time because I meet so many people, but I'm like, man, I am glad I took that extra moment, like wherever that was along the way, to plant that seed of like a respectful interaction, as opposed to like being the kind of guy that's turning people off, which is like could be real easy to do, and like, you know, brushing people off and like, we're busy. I know you're busy. I know I'm busy. And like sometimes I'm trying to protect my time, and that might come off as like disrespectful, but I do my best to try to, you know, open a door and be like polite, respectful, plant those seeds, because you never know. You never know who's going to, you know, come back around. And, you know, it's way better to have good out there circulating back, right?
No question about it. Yep, I agree 100% what you just said.
Yep. Cool. So let's talk about markets for a second. We didn't talk about where you prefer to buy. What are your favorite markets now? Do you have like a specific investment philosophy for how you're buying, holding, maybe renovating, maybe selling? Like what's kind of the long-term focus in combination with the markets?
Yeah, so we buy in Texas, Florida, Alabama, Tennessee, but the Texas where we first started, that's where I grew, you know, I've been living. It's getting pretty expensive here. So we started moving into, and you mentioned Atlanta. We started moving to Atlanta, you know, a couple of years ago, 2.5, almost 3 years ago now. And we own a couple thousand units, there now. And I still like Atlanta a lot. I just look at it that it's getting more expensive than it was, of course, a couple of years ago, even a year ago, but it's a couple of years behind Dallas, and it might not catch Dallas, frankly. I mean, it might not, but it doesn't need to. It's still doing really well with the job growth and population growth and things like that. We're more recently getting into Florida. We bought one property there last year and have three more. We just closed one actually 2 weeks ago there and have two more in Florida as well that we're closing on. So we're getting more into Florida as well. So Southeast, I like a lot. It's where a lot of the people are moving to, and some of those too, like, you know, Florida, they have state income tax. So some advantages there. Philosophy, we kind of buy a lot of different types of deals. We buy some properties that are, you know, like we have one right now going under contract at 61% occupied, so really, really low, of course. And then we have some that are like 93% occupied, and some that are $4,000 a door rehab, and some that are $20,000 a door rehab. So kind of all different types. And we just, you know, some of our investors like different flavors of deals, and, you know, the ones that are a lot more, you know, 61%, it's a bigger repositioning for sure. More effort, more money, all those things like that. Could be more time. But I, you know, if I had to pick this my own, I would like, I'd buy probably, you know, mid to late 80s construction, you know, $4,000 kind of run of the mill rehab, 92% occupied. Those are the easy ones in my mind. The returns might not be as much on a deal like that. So that's why kind of why we do buy a lot of different deals. And one deal we did, we, you know, did a refi after 14 months and pulled out, I think it was an 87% of the capital pretty fast to be doing that.
Nice. Can we talk about the first year of ownership? I just bought like a 10 unit and like half the tenants are bad. It's just like everything that could go wrong is wrong right now. And I know it's going to get better and the numbers pan out, but like, can we talk about what's your average experience now that you're doing 4,000, almost 5,000 plus units over the course of your career on that first year to 18 months of ownership? What are some of the nightmares to expect on a deal?
It's going to depend a little bit on the property class and location and things like that. But at a minimum, no matter what, your first 2 months are kind of, I'll say, a mess, but you have no idea what's going on because you have so many one-time things happening, you know, whether some of the checks for rents are going to the old, you know, the old owner, and you have utility deposits. First 2 months, you're kind of like, I don't even, you know, can't trust this stuff yet. Third month is when you start kind of looking, it's a little bit more in line with what's going to happen. But, you know, it's usually 15 to 20 days after the month ends. So you're 3.5, almost 4 months in before you're like, okay, this is really what this it looks like, which is a long time into the deal. But yeah, you're going to run into, without a doubt, you know, the property management company is going to say, oh, we're evicting all the bad tenants that the old property management company had in there and all the bad debt and things like that. So your occupancy is a good chance could go down. Even though, you know, you think your new management company is better because you're getting rid of people that maybe shouldn't be there. If you're doing rehab, you know, some things are going to cost more than you think, just reality. You need to have things like working capital, and people are like, well, what is that? Well, just put it this way. When you close a deal, there's a lot of other things that could come up that you didn't plan on it, and or you're doing a rehab and the lender's going to reimburse you. We're waiting on our reimbursement right now of $326,000 for some rehab work we did. It's been going on for 6 months, like literally with a lender. Wow. So those type of things can come up and you're like, okay, I better have some money set aside to handle these type of things. And not every single deal is going to have all the same issues, but if you do enough deals, you're going to hit, you know, various issues like this. So having more money set aside than maybe you think you need, I mean, you've never been stressed about having too much money there, but the reverse is true. And just keep in mind that, like you mentioned, your deal, it's a slow go sometimes your first year and you get, you know, frustrated. You might be like, man, I need to maybe just sell this property. You know, I can make a decent money selling it. And generally speaking, it comes down to just the people on site. So you're going to have to really keep an eye on them. You want to monitor how they're performing. We get like a Monday morning report that shows us kind of different stats and things like that. And you might have to make a shift and get rid of the on-site manager and things like that. They're not performing. But keeping a close eye on them for sure. And even with a close eye, things are going to still come up, unfortunately. So just be patient. Understand it's kind of for the long haul. But with that said, you know, at some point in time, you might have to make a decision and say, okay, well, we're better off selling the property because, you know, we can make the business plan work, you know, sooner that way and things like that. But, you know, kind of when you're going through your stuff, definitely frustrating when you buy your first properties for sure. You could have a murder on there, fire, you know, different various crime activities going on there. And at first you're kind of freaking out. You're like,
yeah, right.
And then you're like, yeah, it's kind of the way it happens, you know, so all those things. And most likely you're going to hit every one of these items if you buy enough properties.
Are there any valuable lessons regarding either hiring a management company or on-site manager, or maybe like red flags as to when it's time to find a new on-site or property management company that you've learned along the way? Wish you knew at the beginning.
Yeah, one, I definitely wouldn't always go with the cheapest. And you think of that, oh, this person's going to be picking up $300 a door, which can add up, you know, per unit cheaper, which can add up to a lot. And, you know, from a overall perspective, you're looking at it going, I can make more money this way. You typically get what you pay for, like most things. One thing I would never do, it's just from a personal experience. It was a bad experience where I had a partner who was also the property manager. He had a property manager company. We had to remove him. That became a little more complicated because he was also a general partner in the, you know, in the deal and things like that. So I wouldn't do that personally, saying you shouldn't do it, but I wouldn't do that again. And, you know, as far as monitoring, you can give them time. I mean, you have to like, monitor it, meaning you have to have like hard facts, like what the occupancy is going to be, how many people have, you know, visited the property, how many conversions have you had. If you're just like trying to talk to the on-site or the regional manager as far as what's going on with no facts, it's really, really hard. So you have to have a way to monitor. And if things start getting worse and they don't have a plan in place that you feel is comfortable that's going to, you know, turn that around, then you might have to make a decision to go with a new managing company. But it's a big decision to do that. I mean, it can cause a lot of, you know, stress, and it doesn't always get better first either. So now you're in a situation where you're waiting, you know, another couple months before it starts getting better. But I would just say monitor them, make sure they're doing what they say they're going to do. And if they're not, then look at potentially replacing them.
Yeah, nothing can be said enough about monitoring the numbers. And that goes for any business. You really got to figure out what numbers are important, and you got to watch the numbers like a hawk. And then you got to be able to figure out, like, what's the story behind the numbers? Like, what are the numbers telling me? Obviously, the number of, you know, inquiries leads to the number of showings, leads to the number of applications, right, leads to the number of new signed leases. And then that property management thing, I asked the question, it's loaded, because I had to get rid of a property manager only on, like, I think I had seven houses. But it was like $30,000 in rent that's gone. And then when I got rid of the property manager, like, all the tenants either started paying or were paying the whole time, and the property manager just was, I hate to say he's stealing from me. He had bad accounting, or maybe he wasn't getting the checks, but yeah, that's probably really, really what was going on. The guy, you know, was falling apart at the seams. And then it was like you said, I had a round of evictions, and I had to get stable with the new property management company, who, thank God, has been solid ever since. So we talked about quite a few different topics here. Are there any questions that I didn't ask that I probably should have, that you'd be able to give the audience the answer in question here as we're getting to the wrap up stage?
No, I think the biggest one that we hit is, you touched on, was how do people get started, you know, and the biggest one is adding value and find other people. I think the one just kind of, you know, elaborate on a little bit, is that you have to get off and you know, your butt, if you want to say, and do stuff. When someone says, well, I'm going to go try to find properties and things like that, and they never go visit the location, never meet with brokers, it happens on a regular basis, it's surprising to me, but you might have to get on a plane and go meet with the brokers. You have to develop that relationship. You don't have to go there every week or every month or things like that, but initially, there's nothing that's going to replace that face-to-face interaction. And you need to do that if you're going to be doing business with these people, because it'll show that you're committed. So that, go to events, go to free meetups, go wherever. And it doesn't happen by sitting at home hoping it's going to happen. You have to get out there. And I understand. You mentioned your daughter. I think there's that too. It's a time suck sometimes. You know, we're going to Denver on Friday for an event, and we were just there 3 weeks ago. I'll go back there again in February, you know, things like that. I'm not saying everyone has to do that, but if it's something you really want, you're going to have to take massive action to make it happen.
Well said. Are there any books that listeners should check out, maybe in the apartment space, or maybe just in, you know, the business or self-development space in general, that were impactful for you along the way, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, the one obvious one, and it's not obvious that not everyone's read it, is Rich Dad Poor Dad. I mean, that was eye-opening for sure. I think there are a lot of other real estate books out there too. Kenny McElroy, a lot of people probably know him too. He has some very good, kind of, I say, easy-to-read books as well, like ABCs of Real Estate and things like that. So that I'd check him out. End of the day, I think, you know, the podcast, reading books and things like that are all great. But I would also say, try to find somebody you can team up with and tag along with and learn. Like, we have it in our group where people might have a deal and they bring four or five other people on the deal with them to go to due diligence and participate in some of the lender calls and things like that. Nothing can replace that actual hands-on experience. So try to, that's where getting out there, meeting people becomes critical so you can do that.
Makes sense. If you could go back to your, I don't know what you were, a 20, 22-year-old self, when you were buying that first piece of rental real estate in your life, and you could share the crown jewel of wisdom with yourself, knowing what you know now, what would that be?
I'd say, you know, it doesn't come down to skill or anything like that, because that can be developed. I think it, I didn't value networking and relationships early on. I wouldn't say that I didn't need to. I mean, I kind of, you know, a small little town, there's only like two people that sold properties really in our town. But now that I've been doing it longer, the amount of value I put on people I know and connections in my network, I mean, one person can save you, you know, from making a huge, huge mistake, or one person can make an introduction that can put you in connection with, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. And I think really nurturing and developing relationships is the one thing I wish I would have done a better job of when I was younger.
Yeah, it's funny. I remember jumping out of a couple of partnerships where I was making good money, the most money that I ever had made in my life up to that point. And I look back, you know, one of those moments I'm covering my mouth in shame, like, oh, God, I can't believe I did that. But things were going well, and I jumped out of that partnership and, like, went broke on the heels of it. And it was solely because I saw the money. The money being made was the biggest money I'd ever seen, Mark. It was, you know, flipping houses money. And I thought, like, to myself, oh, I need to make all that money. And, like, looking back, I pulled apart from the experience, the contacts, the network, the sources of capital, a whole bunch of things I didn't place enough value on, or place enough value on the people I was in business with and their experience level. I wonder what it would look like if I did not do that early on. And
right.
Yeah, who knows, right?
Yeah.
If anybody's listening and would like some more information about you, your coaching program, et cetera, do you want to share somewhere they can get a little more, Mark Kenny?
Yeah, sure. Probably the best way is just email me. It's Mark, M-A-R-K, at thinkmultifamily.com, or visit our website too, thinkmultifamily.com. But either way, we're more than happy to chat with people and kind of share or discuss anything people want to go over.
All right, cool. Well, hey, Mark, I appreciate you taking some time out, blocking out the distractions, and sharing of your wisdom today. Appreciate you coming on the show.
No, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Coming up on the next episode, Richard Wilson joins us to discuss how to leverage to larger deals through the use of family office investments. Family offices are organizations set up by wealthy families to manage their own wealth. A few well-known famous family offices include the DeVos Family Office, whose family founded Amway, and the Rockefeller Family Office. However, there are countless family offices commanding hundreds of billions of dollars seeking a home, or rather an investment. Family offices make investments in the real estate space in addition to their publicly traded equity portfolios, and are always looking for qualified operators to run those investments. So you'll want to keep an eye out for that one. Attention deal makers, I am buying. I buy houses and apartment complex deals in Atlanta, Chicago, and Philadelphia, anywhere 2-hour drive around those cities. So if you have a deal, please contact me directly using the form at reidiamonds.com. Accredited investors receive double-digit returns by passively investing in real estate. If you'd like more info on that, go to fundrehabdeals.com. That concludes this episode. Thanks again for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here, signing off.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.